principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore and chart uncharted waters. To that end, the crew of the Beagle would drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. The measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been and would serve to guide those who followed.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, listen now to our program called Soundings. Thoughts and ideas about the present and the future with an appreciation for the past. Your host is Wayne Pond.
Dr. Stephen Marcus is professor of English at Columbia University in New York City, where he was educated and where he's taught since 1961. Professor Marcus has written several books and numerous articles and monographs about literature and society in 19th century England, primarily about the Victorian period, which embraces the years between 1837 and 1901. Dr. Marcus has written about the novels of Charles Dickens, the political theory of Marx and Engels, and he's worked as an editor on the writing of Sigmund Freud. He's the author of a book entitled The Other Victorians, a study of sex and sexuality and of the underground press in Victorian England. Professor Marcus has received fellowships and awards from the Guggenheim Foundation, the Fulbright Commission, the American Council of Learned Societies, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences. He is currently a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina.
The popular notion now is that we can blame our sexual hang-ups on the Victorians. Is that fair?
Well, I would have to say that the answer to that question is both yes and no. I think it's probably fair to say that people in civilized society, insofar as we're familiar with it, have always had sexual problems. No society that is known to anybody, as far as I know, doesn't have some people with certain sexual problems. At certain points in history, however, people in certain kinds of social situations become more aware than they would otherwise or at other times be of the fact that they do have sexual problems. And I think that this is one of the things that characterizes the Victorian period, is a growing consciousness that in civilization, and in particular in Western civilization, there was and there is a problem of sexuality. That is to say, there is a problem of the relations between the sexes, and that the relations between the sexes do not seem to be anything remotely resembling what civilization posits as its ideal. That is to say, the relations between the sexes tend to be pretty bad. One of the things that characterizes Victorian society is the growth, the slow growth in various sectors of that society, of the idea that relations between men and women were not what they should be, had gone wrong.
We have a notion of the Victorians as either extremely repressive or characterized by underground literature, the libertine kind of thing.
Well, I think you have to recall that Victorian England was the first time in modern civilization when society really dominated by the middle class, what we know today as the middle class, existed. That is to say, the old aristocratic order was in the process of dissolving, and the middle class was in a state of ascendancy. And middle class notions of propriety and family and domesticity and what was decent in public life and in private affairs became the dominant mode, or dominated the tone of society for the first time.
Well, you've written a book called The Other Victorians. Who were the other Victorians?
They really are the same Victorians as everybody else. The other Victorians are the same Victorians when they turn their consciousness to the problems of sexuality, really. Medical men who dealt with sexuality, who were libertines of one kind or another, who did become who were involved in the production of literature that had to do with sexuality, and so that is to say, the other Victorians were those Victorians that were more or less excluded from what the official view or the officially accepted view of what life was like was taken to be.
Well, what was the Victorian notion of sex?
There wasn't a unitary one. There were a variety of notions of sexuality, as there are today. And I think you'd probably find them distributed according to some rough socioeconomic set of determinants. That is to say, if you were to define or divide the society into, let's say, the aristocracy, the middle class, and the working classes, you'd find roughly different notions of sexuality distributed among these classes, or roughly different notions of what appropriate sexual behavior was.
Well, what were the notions of sexual behavior in these classes?
Well, the aristocratic notion, I think, was a traditional one, which was that people, both men and women, are naturally rather, in their youth, sexually endowed. They have the rights and prerogatives to live a fairly free sexual life, especially men, but women too. And if you didn't make a public display of yourself and were fairly discreet, pretty much anything was allowed.
So this accounts for figures like Lily Langtree and her liaison with the Prince of Wales.
Yes, it accounts for general aristocratic behavior among both men and women, which was, I wouldn't say generally promiscuous, but by prevailing standards, fairly permissive. That is to say, sexual activity was seen as fairly natural and was generally condoned. Now, middle class notions tended to be different. Middle class notions, which are the notions that we have inherited more than the others, I think, tended to dichotomize the sexes and to see men as more sexually active than women, to see women in essentially domestic roles rather than economic and entrepreneurial roles. Men ran the economy, men did the work in the world, they were energetic and active. Women tended to be domestic, passive, mothers, and so on. And the dominant view in the middle classes was that women were less sexually endowed than men.
You use the term energetic. I've heard it said that that sex was viewed as literally a form of energy among the Victorians, peculiar primarily to men and not necessarily to women, that is, in terms of these middle class stereotypes that you're discussing.
I think this is true. The dominant metaphors of the society had to do with the chief economic, socioeconomic kinds of activity. And these had to do with the Industrial Revolution, with production and with commerce and things like that. Now, in these activities, production was stressed, and capital was stressed, and accumulation was stressed.
And these had sexual correspondences.
And these were used metaphorically in relation to sexuality as well. Sexual activity was an expenditure of energy. That male ejaculation was the equivalent of an outpouring, as it were, of capital. And the popular word for the orgasm in the Victorian period was to spend. This is a word that's no longer used to any extent, but it was a word used commonly throughout the 19th century.
Here is one parallel between Victorians and money,
mm-hmm.
which seemed to dominate all levels of that society. Isn't that true?
Yes, well, it was, after all, a great capitalist society. It was the center of the Industrial Revolution. It was in the advance guard of the world economically. It makes perfect sense that the predominant form of socioeconomic activity should permeate, as it were, other forms of consciousness.
did the underground press have a corollary in the sense that there was a repressive press?
Well, the underground press consisted of a small but nevertheless adequate group of publishers and printers who made their living printing a variety of materials such as songs, limericks, poems, magazines, novels, and then when photography was invented in the 1830s after that, in the decades after that, photographs that had to do with sexual activities, depicting and describing and representing sexual activities. These were fairly widely distributed. It wasn't difficult to get hold of these materials if you wanted to get hold of them. I would say that in answer to your question, was there an official repressive press? The answer again is would have to be complicated. There wasn't much official censorship, but there was a lot of self-censorship. That is to say, you didn't have to nobody had to tell novelists like Dickens or Thackeray or George Eliot what could be said and what couldn't be said. They knew themselves what could be said and what couldn't be said, and nobody exercised censorship on them. They exercised it on themselves. So there was really never any question about, in Dickens' mind, what he could or he couldn't say. He made up his mind himself. It was clear that he could say pretty much, almost, he said pretty much anything he wanted, but that what he wanted to say was bounded by a notion of propriety, which allowed him to say certain things, but not to say others. However, that didn't prevent him from writing very great novels.
I remember when I read Adam Bede.
Mm-hmm.
In one chapter, the young woman, the heroine, whose name I forget, does not have a baby, and at the beginning of the next chapter, bingo, she does.
Yeah, Hetty Sorrell is her name. She's going to have an illegitimate baby, you know, and that she does have an illegitimate baby, and that she kills it, drowns it in a pond. No bones are made about the fact that that she's had this affair with this young gentleman who was the chief landholder in the shire, and that the punishment that's going to come upon her, although it's an official one for infanticide, is also largely self-inflicted too. So again, the fact that a young woman had a passionate affair and was not married and had this baby and so on, is it, of course she's punished for it, but that didn't prevent George Eliot from saying it or expressing it.
Professor Marcus, how would you describe the remnants of Victorian sexuality? Are we indeed the inheritors of repressive notions about sex?
I think that in a way we do inherit many of the notions that the Victorians had, insofar as we believe that there are different roles sexually for men and women, although we may not believe that these roles are so sharply dichotomized and clear-cut as the Victorians did, insofar as we believe that probably there's a division of labor between father and mother to some extent, you know, not entirely, insofar as we believe that there is a differentially appropriate behavior for boys and girls, you know, insofar as we're not totally unisex, let's say, yes, we have inherited those kinds of notions. Now, insofar as we no longer believe that virginity is the sine qua non for a young woman, then we've broken with that notion. But there are lots of perfectly decent Victorian women who got married who are not virgins, too. So it's not as if this was a totally a homogeneous society. However, it would seem to me that there's a great deal of continuity between the Victorians and ourselves, insofar as we have our own neuroses, and our own neuroses have sexual sides and sexual, as it were, centers and parts to them. Yes, then there's real continuity between ourselves and our grandparents.
National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation. Here again is your host, Wayne Pond.
Dr. Stephen Marcus is professor of English at Columbia University in New York City and a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Professor Marcus is an authority on literature and society in 19th century England, particularly during the Victorian period, which spans the years between 1837 and 1901. Dr. Marcus is the author of half a dozen books and numerous articles about the Victorian age. Among his books is The Other Victorians, a study of sex and sexuality and the underground press in Victorian England, the subject of Professor Marcus's discussion for the Center's radio program, Soundings. Professor Marcus, would you say that by comparison with the Victorians, would you say that our society is permissive? That's a word that gets kicked around a lot. People use it to characterize America in the 1980s.
I think we're permissive generally in that we're probably more tolerant of widespread sexual behavior than the Victorians. And certainly the modern technological advances in contraception have made sexual behavior much safer in the sense of the consequences than it was in the past. I think that the advent of things like the birth control pill and so on have really, made change possible. Are we permissive, however, in the positive sense? I'm not so sure. That's true. I think that we are permissive in the sense that there's a great deal of confusion now about what is appropriate behavior. We're permissive in the sense that we're not certain where authority is and what appropriate authority is. That fathers don't believe that they have the right to say no to children because they're not certain of what they themselves believe in the way their grandfathers did. So that I would say, yes, we are permissive, but the permissive is permissiveness largely by default and by confusion and by weakening of values rather than permissive in the positive, assertive sense in which we say, yes, we know that this is right and therefore go ahead and have, a lot of fun.
Would you say that the Victorians lived in a patriarchal society? You mentioned the notion of authority and how we seem to have lost touch with that in our families.
Yes, I think that in comparison to our society, their society was as they say, patriarchal. It was assumed that the middle class nuclear family was the essential unit of society, that the husband and father was the dominant partner. And indeed, legally, this was true right through the period, although laws were passed during the period giving women greater control over property than they had before. The father who made the money or inherited the money and controlled the money essentially ruled the family, although within the family itself, within the household itself, the mother or the wife or the female had a good deal of authority. I would say that compared to what we have today in middle-class America, let's say, yes, the lines of authority were more distinct and more cleanly, as it were, defined than they are now. However, was it patriarchal in the sense that it was entirely despotic? That I would say no.
You mentioned Charles Dickens and the way some Victorian writers treat sex. We've discussed Adam Bede and George Eliot. Would you say that the books that are written today, for instance, John Fole's novel, The French Lieutenant's Women, mm-hmm. or Woman, is that accurate in the way it presents Victorian life and sexual codes?
Well, I think Fole's is. Novel is set a little earlier, in the early part of the 19th century. But yes, I think he's done a lot of historical homework, and that his representation of the way men and women behaved and felt about sexuality is consonant with what we find in the writings about the middle class themselves. Although, as always, one finds a great variety. Nobody ever said, you know, that there's a single or a unitary view about sexuality in the Victorian period. There are many views of it, and these views were, you know, ranged quite widely. There were some people who did believe, as I said, among the upper classes, there was never any doubt that women were sexual and sexually alive. And among the middle classes themselves, certain people were aware that women did have sexual feelings. Other people denied that this was so. That there clearly was a problem about sexuality, and especially with females, is best indicated by the fact that a Victorian physician named Sigmund Freud made all his discoveries, you know, through his patients, who were women suffering from various forms of sexual hysteria.
And it's not necessarily fair to characterize the whole epic, or is it fair to characterize the epic, generalizing from what Freud passes to us?
I would seem to me that it's not fair, as it were, just to say simply that it was a repressive society. It's too complex a society.
Which of the Victorian writers most faithfully, most accurately portrays the notions of sex and patriarchy and the relations between men and women in Victorian literature?
Well, I think that they all do from different points of view. It seems to me that from the point of view of women, for example, Charlotte Bronte, for example, in a novel like Jane Eyre or another novel like Villette, gives a very, very acute portrayal of what the problems of being a woman with ambition and energy and sexuality were like then. And I think the same thing can be said of George Eliot, too. And in her last novel, let's say, Daniel Deronda, she has a marvelous portrait of a woman named Gwendolyn Hollis, who really is suffering from hysteria. Yeah? There's no better representation of, you know, what it is like to be hysterical than you find in Daniel Deronda.
What do you mean by hysteria?
Well, one means a variety of things, but the specific form that hysteria, the specific forms that hysteria took, tended to take epidemically in the 19th century, was you know, of terrific anxiety and fear of sexuality, of heterosexual activity as such. And this is what Gwendolyn Hallett suffers from.
Is it true that the term hysterectomy originates in the Victorian notion of removing the female's reproductive organs to calm her down and make her a docile social creature?
Well, the etymology of the word hysteria comes from the Greek word for womb, yeah? And therefore it was believed, for example, that it was impossible for men to have hysteria because they didn't have wombs. I don't know the medical history of the hysterectomy itself. It's a radical operation, and it would seem to me that the chances of anybody surviving it in the Victorian period, given the state of the medical art then, was very low. So I'm not sure that hysterectomies were performed to any extent during the period.
How would you characterize the relation or the rise of the so-called women's movement in terms of the transition from the Victorian notion of sexuality to the ideas that we have inherited and live by today?
Well, the women's movement really begins at the end of the 19th century. And it begins with women campaigning for a more active role in public life, for things like the vote, for a right to participate politically in life, and so on. And it seems to me very important growth and a natural outgrowth of the other reforms in the nature or in the direction of democracy politically that took place in the 19th century. It seems to me that the women's movement that came back to life in the 1960s and that is still very active with us is a direct descendant of the first form of the women's movement that began in the 1890s. and lasted at least until the First World War. After that, it lapsed again. But there's a direct connection between the first phase of the women's movement, which started in the 1890s, and the second phase, which started in the 1960s.
Did the Victorians think of men and women as equal?
No, they did not think of them as equal. They thought of them as different. And we tend to think of them more as equal than as different. And I think that if they, as it were, erred in going too far in one direction, we may have erred in going too far in the other. Because although I believe that men and women are equal, I also believe that they're different.
Professor Marcus, how would you characterize the social roles or the social models of sexuality, men and women, in the Victorian period?
Social roles differed according to social status and social class. Among the aristocracy, nobody was wasn't expected that men worked, you say. Among the working class, it was expected often that both men and women worked. Among the middle class, it was expected that men did the work of the world and women did not work, and that women tended the home and were in charge of domestic arrangements, child rearing, and so on. So there were differential social models or roles according to which class you're talking about.
How is it that we now in the 1980s see social roles as unisex?
Well, I think it's a very complex question, a complex set of questions. The situation that we're in now is characterized, of course, by something that didn't exist in the 19th century in either England or America, which is, one, universal education, and two, close to universal higher education, in the sense that 50% of the cohort in the United States goes on to some form of higher education or not. Now, one of the things that accompanies this remarkable development is, in fact, that both sexes work now to a much greater degree, or women, let's say, work much more universally, or much closer to universally than they did in the 19th century. They make up a much larger part of the workforce. But that goes along with the fact that we have more permissive divorce laws, that the age of childbirth and child rearing has steadily risen families now tend to be smaller than they ever were, that we have a zero population growth. So that on the largest scale, there have been social changes between the situation 100 or 75 years ago and now that no one could have predicted then, and that make most of the comparisons seem very dramatic.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation, in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the center is William Bennett. Soundings is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
This is Bill Bennett, Director of the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, inviting you to listen this week for the Center's radio program, Soundings. This week on Soundings, you'll hear a discussion of sexual mores, the underground press, and literature and society in Victorian England, with Professor Stephen Marcus of Columbia University. Professor Marcus is the author of The Other Victorians, a controversial study of the private lives of the Victorians. Join us this week for Soundings.